From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, an up-close look at Detroit's water shutoffs.
The people that are affected are low-income seniors and those that are having discrepancies on their water bills.
Should state lawmakers get nearly 12 weeks off for summer?
Legislators are like, you know, sort of they're representative of the citizens. You have really smart people, really hardworking people, and then people that don't fit that category.
Michigan abolitionist Laura Haviland, a 19th century powerhouse.
She was willing to leave her own children in the care of others to fight for what she believed was justice. It's an incredible story.
So why don't we know who she is? Those stories and more today for you on Stateside. Michigan abolitionist Laura Smith Haviland was a 19th century powerhouse. So why don't we know who she is? I'm Cynthia Canty. Today on Stateside, we'll hear why a preacher's daughter from Lenawee County was so important to the Underground Railroad. Then we check up on Michigan's Lake Sturgeon, Walleye, and Lake Whitefish, the latest chapter in a decade-plus effort to boost native fish in the St. Clair River. That's later this hour. But first, Detroit's water crisis is making worldwide headlines. The city is stepping up efforts to collect from the 90,000-some residents and businesses behind on their water bills. First came shutoff notices. Then water was turned off to some 15,000 customers in April through June, many of them low-income or seniors or both. The Detroit Water Brigade is one of the groups helping those who've lost water. D'Amico Williams is a chief coordinator with the group. D'Amico, just how is the Detroit Water Brigade trying to help these people?
Yes, thank you for having me, Cynthia. Yes, the Detroit Water Brigade is an advocacy relief rapid response group that provides water to families that have been shut off in the Detroit water crisis. We provide lots of love, empathy, compassion, and we let people know that this is not their fault, but this now has become their fight.
Where are the donations coming from, the money or the bottled water?
The donations is coming from our website at DetroitWaterBrigade.org. We have a Amazon wedding registry set up in the name of the Detroit Water Brigade where it has jugs of water, other supplies such as rain barrels, water filtration devices, and especially aqua tablets that could change the quality of the drinking water and make it clean and accessible to drink within 30 minutes. We also have resource hubs and neighbor hubs that are opening up. We have three on the west side and two on the east side of Detroit. And they're growing because people are trying their best to manage with what they have, but it is a very dire situation. You know, we're coming across people in our canvassing that have not had water, lights, or gas for more than a year. Even some were living without water and lights throughout the polar vortex of the winter.
Well, D'Amico, take us, if you will, into the homes that some of the homes you visited. And what stories have really hit you the hardest?
The story that makes me emotional is Nicole Hill. Nicole Hill was featured on the NBC Evening News last weekend or so, and that's what really hit home for me. When we went to her house, we went to give her, when I pulled up on the scene, we gave her a case of water. And when we went into her home, there was a stench from the refrigerator. Her floors were sticky. She usually keeps her home clean. Her dishes has not been cleaned in the past 2 weeks due to no water. Her children is staying with another relative. And another story that kind of hit me was a senior that said that she is acted in good faith in paying her bills, but due to her pension being reduced, she was a City of Detroit retiree, and she said that now she can't pay for her prescriptions, she's been having health issues, and she needs water, and they shut her water off, and she's tried to go to her church and friends that she know, and no one could help her, and it really put me in a place of feeling like, you know, there has to be something done about this water crisis. I have called for a community meeting or a public event thrown by the Detroit Water and Sewage Department to be at Cobo Hall in the new Grand River Ballroom to accommodate a 90,000 to 120,000 Detroiters to talk about their situations and to work out some sort of a payment plan until we get the water affordability plan in place. However, there are a lot of there's 12,000 people now without water. We're trying to service families that call into our hotline number. We dispatch to them. And it's just very dire. You know, people have this narrative that if you don't pay your bills, you get shut off. This is not like your cable bill. This is not your cell phone bill. This is not your grocery bill. This is about water. It's about being accessible and affordable. And to those people that say, pay your bills or get water from the river, how about you pay your student loan debt? How about you pay your credit card bill? How about we look into your tax bills? We cannot judge people's personal financial situations because we don't know people's financial situations.
The city, D'Amico, says that 50 to 60% of the homes that were cut off had the water turned back on within 48 hours. After the customer reached out and arranged a payment plan, and they say funding is coming together to help those who just can't pay. Can you help us understand, did people make a call or did they not make a call and ask for help when the bills first started coming? I guess I'm wondering, why did it take a shut off to get people to make a call or ask for help?
Okay, let me take you back through a chronological timeline real quick. In March, when they announced the shutoffs, 2 days before, emergency manager Kevin Orr had sent privatization bids for the water department to be privatized after the regional authority concept failed. Now the Detroit Water Department is trying to collect the delinquency because this regional authority did not want to deal with the delinquency of Detroit, so the water department is taking an aggressive approach. They claim that 60% of people came down after they were in a frantic, begging their neighbors, their relatives, their family, you know, to help them come up with 30% of the bill, and they're still not honoring it. This is a discrepancy I have because this is wasting money, time, and resources to send Homridge, the private contractor, to shut off the water, put the family in stress and worry, and then have them come down to the water department to pay 30% of whatever that was the bill, and then send Homridge back out to shut back on the water. Now you just wasted money, time, and resources instead of having a community meeting. Also, let me point this out there. The people that are affected are low-income seniors and those that are having discrepancies on their water bills. When you call the water department, you can't get no answer. You have to leave messages to a system that's broken. And then when you do get someone, you're on hold for 45, 50 minutes, and then they come and tell you something over the phone that's way entirely different than what you should be told in person. And instead of us calling them, they need to come to us. Come out from that water board building and let's get in a centralized location to where 90,000 to 120,000 Detroiters can come down and get their water bills settled so that no one won't be facing shutoff. I do understand that the water department is trying to run a business. I do understand that they need to collect the revenue, but going about it in this uncoordinated effort is not the way, and it's putting our city at risk.
D'Amico, how do you see this being resolved?
I don't see no resolve to this. I don't see them doing anything to reprieve the situation. Daryl Latimer, I've been in many conversations with him, including our appearance on Let It Rip, that, you know, this effort that he's doing, he needs to reconsider this. I've also tried to talk with the mayor, and the mayor said that he had no comment, that this is all about, this is from Kevin Orr and Rick Snyder, Governor Rick Snyder. The only resolve that I see is that they need to have this community meeting, and they need to do it at Cobo Hall, in that Grand River Ballroom, and they need to do it extended hours from 8 o'clock a.m. to 8 o'clock p.m. for 5 days, Monday through Friday, and do it another week if you have to, because we have 700,000 people that still live here in the city of Detroit, and those people, you know, the majority of them are falling through hard economic circumstances. This man-made bankruptcy is not doing the city any good. The privatization is not doing any good. We call for an end to the shutoffs immediately. If you're not going to shut off Comerica Park, Ford Field, and Eastern Market, three of the highest destinations visited by people in the region, they should never be indebted their water bills.
And they are.
They are. The City of Detroit Golf Course, remember, that's in bankruptcy court. So how much do you anticipate for them getting pennies on the dollar on back on the debt? It's going to be less than $20,000. And Mike Ilitch, Joe Louis Arena owes $80,000. The VA hospital owes $131,000. And they're trying to run the buck on low-income and seniors to pay that bill. And it's unfair. It's unjust. And also, the water department claims that it raised $1 million to help out families that have been shut off, but they're only accommodating families that got up to $1,500. We're coming across people that owe more than $5,000. And there needs to be a water bill analysis to where people can get their water bills analyzed if they're going through the audit or disputing their bills. I know some people around the trail, when we go around the Canvas Trail, that they're telling us that they are being charged for sewage and other fees that don't even make sense. They haven't even used this type of water. Mm-hmm. So what I'm calling on the water department to do is to have this community meeting at Cobo Hall, service these 120,000 Detroiters, sit them down, find out what their financial situations are, find out what is going on, and work with them to put them on a plan so that they would not have their water services shut off. And then we're calling for the water affordability plan to be reinstated by the Detroit City Council. It was passed in 2006, and it was yanked by former Mayor Dave Bing, in 2010 from out the Human Services Department.
D'Amico Williams is with the Detroit Water Brigade. D'Amico, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
And if you want to find out more about the water shutoffs in Detroit, go to michiganradio.org. We have a link to the Detroit Water Brigade and to several Michigan radio reports that have been done over the past few weeks. And there's a phone number posted that you can call if you live in Detroit and your water has been shut off. For all of our travel lovers out there, quick update before we go. Last week on Stateside, we told you Traverse City got its own theme song. Over the weekend, the number was officially unveiled during the Cherry Royale Parade. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. We have all heard of Harriet Tubman of Maryland, the best known of the Underground Railroad's conductors. But the state of Michigan was a crucial stop on the Underground Railroad. Before and during the Civil War, many Michiganders helped slaves escape from the South to freedom in Canada. And women were very important in smuggling these runaway slaves. Women such as Laura Smith Haviland. She is one of the outstanding abolitionists from our state. Tia Miles is with us. She's professor of the Department of African American Studies at the University of Michigan. Tia, why have most of us never heard of Laura Haviland?
Well, I think that some Michiganders have heard of her, but in the larger scheme of things in Underground Railroad history, people don't tend to think of people in the Midwest as being prominent in that movement. They tend to think of Boston, Philadelphia, and New York.
But Michigan geographically was so important just because people could get either across the border Detroit or across mm-hmm. the border at Port Huron. You would think more attention would be focused on Michigan's folks.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that the focus has been on the Northeast in part because there's a larger symbolic meaning attached to Boston in particular as the birthplace of liberty. So people continue that narrative thread into this period of the Underground Railroad and think about Boston and New England, as opposed to the Midwest, which, as you said, was really important because of its location.
Why is this preacher's daughter from Albion so important to the Underground Railroad?
Laura Haviland was an incredible woman, and she's someone who faced daunting challenges that you and I don't think, could ever have imagined. She and her family moved from New York to Michigan in 1829, and they were settlers on what they viewed as a frontier. She did heavy domestic labor at the same time that she was raising children, and she was a very faithful Quaker in the area. And over time, she and her husband and her brother started to really think about race issues. She was greatly influenced by another woman in the area named Elizabeth Chandler, who was an anti-slavery poet who had moved from Philadelphia. And together, Haviland and Chandler formed what was the first anti-slavery society in Michigan. It was the Logan Female Anti-Slavery Society.
They were really leading the way. Mm-hmm. How far did Laura Haviland go in helping slaves get to full freedom in Canada? Did she face danger?
Oh, my goodness. Laura Haviland's story is so incredible. She is someone who, in 1845, faced the death of her husband, her parents, and her youngest child from an epidemic that swept through their settlement on the Raisin River. She was a woman who had to run her farm alone with her remaining seven children at a time when women were not expected to be able to do that kind of thing, when everybody questioned her ability. And at the same time that she was doing this, a fugitive slave named George Taylor showed up on her doorstep, and she knew that she had to help him. She had dreams in this period in which she felt that God was telling her that he would protect her if she did his mission, which would be to help slaves escape. And so she left her youngest children in the care of her oldest children, and she traveled all over the Midwest. She went down to Ohio. She even went into Kentucky to try to help slaves escape, which was a very rare thing among women, period, and especially among white women. And she also went to Canada.
And she actually had a reward out, didn't the Southern slave owners $3,000 for her capture?
They did. That's because there was a family named the Hamiltons who were living on Haviland's farmland. And she did this frequently. She invited people who were escaping to come and settle on her land. She would help them, and they would do work on the property. Some Tennesseans came back to capture what they viewed as their heathen property. Lord Haviland got wind of it. She went, again, a woman alone, to confront them and managed to help the family escape to Canada. And the slaveholders were so upset that they pulled a gun on her on a train. And she stood up to them and told them that she was not afraid because they had no power here, meaning in Michigan. They were no longer in Tennessee, she told them.
What a tough lady. Mm-hmm. I can tell just from watching you talk about her how much you admire this woman.
Mm-hmm.
Why?
I admire her because she was someone who was fighting against the odds in her time. I mean, now we're all against slavery. We know it was a terrible moral wrong. At the time that she was so active on the Underground Railroad, it was actually against the law for people, even in the North, to help slaves who were escaping. So after the Fugitive Slave Law was passed in 1850, people in the North who helped slaves escape could lose their own property, could be thrown in jail. Even Haviland's friends were thrown in jail. Nevertheless, she was willing to leave her own children in the care of others to fight for what she believed was justice. It's an incredible story.
Taya, because Laura Smith Haviland was white, did she inspire more whites in Michigan to be part of the cause and to get involved?
Well, there's certainly a number of people who admired her in Michigan and around the Midwest. They thought of her as someone who was a leader in the abolitionist movement. And I think it was a combination of the force of her conviction, her deep belief that God was actually telling her to do the things that she was doing, and also the fact that she was, most of the time, an educator and a school teacher. I mean, she and her brother had founded that school.
Talk about that school.
The school was Raisin Institute, and it was an interracial school, the first of its kind in the state of Michigan. It was modeled after Oberlin College, and the first principals and teachers were from Oberlin. So Haviland was someone who wouldn't necessarily have appeared to other people in her community as a radical rabble-rouser. She was a widowed woman with small children. She was very faithful, first to the Quaker faith, then to the Methodist faith. She was a school teacher. And I think that that allowed people to see her way of thinking a little more easily. She seemed just like them, except that she believed that everyone should have equal rights in this country.
What does history tell us, Taya? How did Laura Haviland's experience differ from white men who were abolitionists mm-hmm. at the time? Did being female help or hurt her?
Well, at the time that she was doing all of her valiant work, it hurt her because women were not expected to be off on their own on the road. Women were not expected to be even speaking in public. They weren't expected to be involved in political issues. She was doing all of these things. And in fact, some of her fellow abolitionists even kind of gently criticized her about this. So Levi and Catherine Coffin, famous abolitionists who were in Cincinnati at a time when Laura Haviland was very active, pointed out that she probably really shouldn't be crossing the Ohio River into Kentucky to help slaves escape. And she told them that she saw no geographical lines in her Bible.
The National Park Service is hosting its annual conference on the Underground Railroad in Detroit. It's going to run from July 16th to the 20th. I know you're going to be speaking. And the theme is Women and the Underground Railroad. How do you think Laura Haviland's life resonates with us right now in 2014?
I think she is an incredible role model because right now we are surrounded by so many social issues, environmental issues, great problems that we have to face as individuals and as a society. And I think we're often casting about wondering, what can we as individuals do? Well, she is someone who showed that as an individual, even an individual who is in a situation where the odds are against you, you really can make a difference.
Fascinating story. Taya Miles is with the Department of African American Studies at the University of Michigan. And again, the National Park Service Annual Conference on the Underground Railroad in Detroit will be held from July 16th to the 20th. Taya, thank you so much for talking with us on Stateside.
Thanks for having me.
What's one of the first things that jumps to your mind when you think of the city of Jackson? For many, the answer might well be the prison. We even call it Jackson Prison, although its official name is the State Prison of Southern Michigan. Recently on Stateside, we told you about the opening of a new museum at the prison, the Cell Block 7 Prison Museum. It gives you a chance to explore a five-floor, 515-cell prison block. Now, it hasn't housed prisoners for 7 years, but you will get a real feel for life inside and the history of Southern Michigan Prison. And we wondered, how does this all strike the people of Jackson? Is playing host to a huge prison something they shun or own? The mayor of Jackson is with us now. Mayor Jason Smith, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Well, Mayor, on one hand, a source of jobs and revenue, and on the other hand, it is one of the biggest prisons in the nation. What do people think in Jackson about this prison? Does it bother them to be known as a prison town?
I don't think so. I mean, by and large, we've sort of accepted that role throughout history. And for us, it's sort of a point of pride that we had at one point the world's largest walled prison. It was interesting to see the positive reaction of the community when we took this sort of negative, sort of gray cloud that sort of hangs over the county, and we spinned it into a positive and said, yes, we want people to come to prison, but not for the reason you would think. We want them to come to prison to tour the museum and learn about the history of what prison life was like in the state of Michigan from both perspectives, from the guard side and from the inmate side.
What do you think that the museum says about Jackson, about the past, the present, and the future?
Well, I think it shows a large part of our history because the prison has been a part of our community, whether it was the first prison that was inside the city limits or Southern Michigan, which is just outside the city limits. We've sort of embraced that as who we are. It says a lot about the past that we can recognize and acknowledge it as our past and our present as we currently continue to house inmates throughout that campus there and into the future that we want the prison to be sort of a positive for us in the fact that we want people to check it out. We want people to see how important it's been to not just Jackson, but the entire state in terms of how corrections has progressed and evolved over the years, how inmates have been treated over the years, and where the direction is headed and what sort of things that we have to face as a quote-unquote prison community.
Now, the Cell Block 7 Museum it's really only been open for a couple of weeks. I'm just wondering, have you noticed more visitors to Jackson?
We've had quite a few visitors check out the prison museum. The summertime, obviously, with any larger city, we've got a lot of things going on in terms of events and things. So there's been a lot of people coming into town. And one of the things that they've mentioned that they want to check out, in addition to some of the other events that we have going on, is Cell Block 7. So, and then we have people who are here specifically for Cell Block 7, and then they branch out into the community. So it's worked pretty well both ways for us. There's been a lot of buzz about it. And we've had, you know, tour buses and things like that that are starting to make their way into including Cell Block 7 as part of their sort of tour packages and excursions and things like that. So it's been pretty positive so far.
Well, Mayor, when you went through the museum, what impressed you and struck you the most?
Well, it was a lot quieter than what my family has told me stories about, because I come from a family full of corrections officers. And they've always said, you know, when you first start, Cell Block 7 was where you went. And that was where they put all the rookie correction officers and sort of threw them to the wolves, basically. And so I had always heard stories about how it was loud and rambunctious, and, you know, it was just kind of a different feeling, you know, than people throwing toilet paper lit on fire across the dormitory there and things like that. And now when I walk in, it's quiet, and it's eerily quiet. and it's sort of, you feel like a prisoner when you walk in. And when you first get in and you see all the cells and you hear the sound of the door closing, and for me, as you know, as someone who's been in the family like that, the sound of the bars opening and closing didn't really affect me at all. But when we went through the tour as sort of the elected officials and the ribbon cutting and things, every time the doors would close, there would be this like shrill and this silence and then this gasp, and you could always kind of tell it was people that weren't accustomed to hearing that. And so it really gives you a true feel of what prison is actually like. I mean, you can see the weapons that have been crafted by inmates. You can see the ball and chains that they used to use. And then there's the positive things, the timeline of corrections and how they have worked with the inmates to make their lives somewhat better despite being in prison. Education, you know, arts and crafts, you know, jobs, things like that. And so it really gives you a good overall feel from both sides of the bars about what life was like in a prison.
Jason Smith is mayor of Jackson, which is home to the State Prison of Southern Michigan. Mayor, thanks for speaking with us today.
Anytime. Thank you.
The World Cup is over. And even though Germany won, plenty of teams had die-hard fans packing Brazil over the past month. In Detroit, there is another intense fan group. They support the Detroit City Football Club's minor league team, La Rouge. Lucy Perkins and Melanie Crivellis wondered just what it was like to be in the fan section. So they headed to the final home game on Friday at Castec High School.
Are you ready to fight tonight?
Yeah!
My Northern Guard name is Big Vito. Northern Guard is the largest supporter section of Detroit City Football Club. We are the 12th man. We're going to do our job and help our team do their job. This is DCFC versus the Fort Pitt Regiment, the final home game of the regular season. This is our home turf. We have the supporter section, and that's where we're doing the singing and the chanting.
Detroit.
Fans will come and go. Fans will sit a game out. Supporters are there in the stands singing, cheering, clapping, and we're behind our team 100% every game.
Detroit City, unassisted goal on number 10.
And I feel great. I'm wearing, of course, my DCFC shirt. I'm wearing my Northern Guard scarf. I'm wearing my war horn and my big glittery gold helmet with glittery red demon horns.
Detroit!
Well, we just won. DCFC is more fun to watch than the World Cup. It's hard to say anything except I feel absolutely amazing after that. People want to talk about the revitalization of Detroit, and they point to downtown and they point to Corktown. This transcends all of that. This is, and not to get overly poetic about it, but all people, all cultures, all creeds, all races coming together to support this team.
A lot of love for football. That was Big Vito cheering on the Detroit City Football Club Friday at Castec. The story was produced by Lucy Perkins with assistance from Melanie Crivellis. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. We keep hearing about lawmakers being on vacation or summer recess, but what does that really mean? They say they're working, meeting with constituents, holding office hours. Are they? How do we know? And does all of it really do anything? And why do voters get so angry when they hear that lawmakers are on a break? Ken Sikkema is the former Republican State Senate Majority Leader. He served in the state legislature in both the House and the Senate from 1987 to 2006. And here with Ken is Michigan Radio's political commentator, Jack Lessenberry. Jack, this summer lawmakers left without serving up that serious way we needed to fund badly needed road repairs. Do you think that got voters extra irked about the summer recess?
Well, of course it did, and there was sort of a perception they left town without getting their job done. Now, of course, you could argue they needed to go think about this some more, and they're not allowed to meet in an official way, but sort of have discussions with their constituents. But no, people are sort of mad about that, and I think that has added extra attention to the whole question of whether they're earning their pay.
Well, I'm looking at the legislative calendar as we speak, the 2014 calendar, and from June 13th to September 9th, there are 4 days marked as session days, 2 in July, 2 in August. Ken, should lawmakers get so much time off during the summer?
Well, it's a lot of time off, but I think the operative word is here whether it's really off, because it's simply true that legislators, and not just in Michigan, but in other states as well, use these recess periods to do a lot of constituent work. In the case of Michigan, during the summertime, it's a lot of face-to-face constituent work. And one thing that is not well known is that in the summer here in Michigan, it's also a time where a number of legislators do what I would call more in-depth policy work. For example, the Senate has a couple of task forces meeting throughout the summer, one on long-term energy policy, and frankly, one on this issue of transportation. But the average citizen looks at that long period of not being in session and says that's a luxury that very few other people enjoy. But I think the point that has to be made is session time is not all the time that legislators put into their job. There's constituent work, there's policy and legislative work that has to go beyond just session time. The other thing to point out is it's an election year, so legislators, rightly or wrongly, a number of them are spending a lot of time this summer campaigning, particularly if they're running for a different office.
So it sounds like it would be more of the working and meeting constituents and getting the campaign ramped up than good times on the golf course?
Well, many legislators have school-aged children. And like all of us, summer is also a time to find some time for family vacations that you can't really take during most of the year if you have children in school, because your life revolves around that calendar. But like the rest of us, summer is often a little bit more relaxed time. Now, I'm also going to, balance that by saying it's a considerable amount of time to not be in session. But once again, being in session is not the full-time occupation of a legislator. You've got other work you need to do, constituent work, and you need time to do what we want them to do, the in-depth policy work that has to get done before a bill gets to the floor.
Well, let me add something. Senator Sycamore is right, of course, about that. And Senator Sycamore did do that kind of policy work, but not all of them do. Some of them sort of rest on their laurels. Some of them are energetically working other jobs, and some of them work other jobs during session times and miss session because of that. And that's, for some people, sort of a sore point. These folks are getting paid $77,000 a year, and some people think maybe they shouldn't be doing other work. But what we sort of elided over is that a lot of them, and this is also a function of term limits, are either looking for other jobs or they are campaigning for other jobs. My own state representative is spending about 16 hours a day campaigning for a seat in the state Senate. Now, you can argue whether or not that is actually doing what you're paid for. Most people aren't paid by their one job to look for another job, but legislators can do that. And I think that it's absolutely true that a lot of these folks are very high-minded, but some of them aren't.
And, Jack, do you think voters have a lot of awareness that their state representative or state senator is there in the home turf? I mean, are voters aware if there's coffee hours or meetings with constituents?
Well, I'd be curious to know what Ken thinks, but the average voter doesn't know he has a state representative, or if he knows he has one or she has one, they don't know the name of that person. They don't know the difference between the legislature and the Congress, and sort of nuances are lost on them. But the average voter does know this year that these people they elect and pay to go to Lansing, and they want them to fix the roads, and they didn't do it. That's what the average voter knows.
What do you want to add to that, Ken?
Well, a couple of points that Jack made are certainly true. Many legislators actually do have other jobs. If they have a professional occupation, and by that I mean a physician or attorney or accountant or something like that, they're able to kind of do that essentially part-time during the fall and spring and winter when they are in session a lot, and then probably spend more time during the summer. The other thing to keep in mind, and this is, you know, kind of whether you like it or don't like it, is any occupation where basically you're in control of your own time, which is true of legislators, you're going to have some people that work really hard at the job, and then you're going to have some people that really don't work very hard, and the vast majority are in the middle. And I think that's true of any occupation where you're basically in control of your own time. You really don't answer to a boss or a supervisor. And legislators are like, you know, sort of they're representative of the citizens. You have really smart people, really hardworking people, and then people that don't fit that category.
You know, I'd be curious to know if Ken thinks that this problem has been exacerbated by term limits, because with term limits, when you're in your third term as a member of the House or your second term as a member of the Senate, you cannot run again, and you're going to have to find, as Ken rightly said, most of these folks are, I'd say, in their 40s or 50s with school-age kids. They're going to have to find another job, so there's some incentive not to do your job, to be looking for another job.
The question being, has term limits had an impact on this? I think the answer is yes, because, for example, you can only serve 6 years in the Michigan House. So, yes, you have every 2 years, there's a significant number of legislators that can't run again. So, you know, what is on their mind? Well, what they're going to do for gainful employment, you know, come January 1 is what's on their mind. Some of them are campaigning for higher office. So, and some of them looking for other jobs. But yes, because of term limits, I think it's increased the amount of time that is either spent campaigning for a different office or, frankly, just looking for work.
And then we have all the talk about a part-time legislature that's buzzing around the state. So was this an especially inopportune time to head off for that 12-week recess with that huge issue like road repairs just twisting in the wind out there, Jack?
I think the talk of a part-time legislature is kind of like my annual diet resolutions. People talk about it for a while, and then they forget about it because there's a lot of work to get it done, and I buy larger size pants, and people forget about it. There are people who grouse that we should have a part-time legislature. Well, what does that mean? What it means is that we would have people who are in session less, and we would pay them less, but that would increase the pressure, then all of them would have to have other jobs. So, I mean, I don't know as much about it as Ken Sikkema, surely, and I'd put a lot of value into what he thinks about the idea.
Yeah, I've never been a fan of a part-time legislature because I think you get kind of a skewed representation then of people that either are, you know, maybe independently wealthy so they could afford the dramatic lower salary, or you get, you know, people that are, you know, beholden to some interest group, like maybe they had come out of the labor union or something or whatever. And I just think you don't get as representative a legislature as you do without it being part-time. People would be forced to find other employment during their time as a legislator. Now, you do have some that do other jobs, but a lot of them don't. And I just don't think there's much value added to a part-time legislature because, to me, the issue is, do you get a better work product? And I think the answer is no.
I remember, actually, our Lester Graham really crunched those numbers and saw that in a very, very big way when he looked at that part-time legislature. I have a jump ball question to wrap things up. What do you think lawmakers are getting an earful of from their constituents this summer? Jack?
Well, I think Randy Richardville said it best. He says he goes home and his constituents just say, just fix the damn roads. So I think they're probably hearing a lot of that. I want to correct one impression that I may have left. I didn't mean to be completely cynical about legislators who have other jobs. A member of Ken Sikkema's caucus when he was there, State Senator Joe Schwartz, who was there for 16 years. He was also a physician and continued to practice in Battle Creek, and he worked hard at both jobs and didn't slight either one. But there are people who've missed 300-some votes in the legislature because they're off practicing law, and that's the kind of thing I have more of a problem with.
Good point. Ken, what do you think, final question for you, too? What are they hearing from their constituents?
Road funding, and road funding. This job, being a legislator, is really, what did you do for me lately? You could have done all kinds of things, but then by sort of kind of crashing and burning on the road funding and not getting it done right before they left, there's no question that it's road funding that they're hearing about.
Former Republican State Senate Majority Leader Ken Sikkema and Michigan Radio's political commentator Jack Lessenberry, thanks so much to both of you.
A pleasure.
Thank you.
If you build it, they will come. That's the idea behind underwater construction happening right now in the St. Clair River. Two new spawning reefs being carefully assembled of stone pieces to attract more lake sturgeon, walleye, and lake whitefish. The project manager is with us now. Jennifer Reed's also deputy director of the University of Michigan Water Center. Jennifer, this project is a pretty good chunk of money, $3.5 million. Why is it so needed?
It is a large project. And I would like to say that it's not all being spent completely on the construction. We have the resources to do the appropriate pre-construction and post-construction assessment to make sure the project's working. So we're not just dropping rock in the water and walking away. The reason it's important is because it's helping to restore spawning habitat for those species of fish you just mentioned that has been basically destroyed over time in the St. Clair and Detroit River systems. So those species are down in numbers, and we'd like to see them increase in numbers.
What destroyed them? What destroyed the traditional spawning materials?
Well, a number of things. I think one of the biggest issues was the deepening of the channels for navigation. Commercial navigation had a big impact. Obviously, that's an important activity. But also, you know, the stuff we do on the land impacts what happens in the water. So agriculture, urban development increases sediment in the water. And then those rocky areas that the fish like to spawn in can get silted in.
And so there you are, building spawning habitats in 30 to 50 feet of water. How do you do that?
Well, it's a very interesting process. First of all, it requires a marine construction company. They basically bring out two large barges. Those barges are studded into the bottom of the river. It's very fast flowing in these areas, so they can't keep station just with motors. They basically stud into the bottom of the river using big metal bars. And one of the barges has on it this apparatus with a big arm and a long shovel that's on a big wire. And the second barge comes alongside loaded with the material. It's 4 to 8 inch broken limestone. And they pick up a big shovelful of this material and very carefully lower it over the side and only let it go very close to the bottom. So we're not just dumping the rock in and it's being swirled away in the current. It's being placed very specifically in very specific locations in the bottom of the river.
Are there divers down there helping too, or is it all GPS?
It's all GPS. So that shovel I mentioned has a GPS unit on it so that we know in three dimensions, so where it is, latitude and longitude and also depth of the river, where each shovel of rock goes. We do check with divers after it's placed, but they're not in the water during placement. It's dangerous.
And you've already done this near Belle Isle. You've done this near the Fighting Islands. So you know what they like. You know what the fish want.
That's right. We've done a lot of work. I would say this work is the best example of adaptive management I know because we've been using different types of materials configured in different ways. And as we learn from each project, we incorporate that learning into the next project. And so this one, which is our fourth or fifth project, really, we've got it narrowed down to the specific type of rock, locations in the river, and we're very confident that we've got a good process in place.
Why is it so important, especially to manage for sturgeon?
Well, sturgeon are a pretty charismatic species, for one thing. But they're also in a somewhat precarious state. They're at approximately 1% of their historic population levels. They're a state-threatened species. And so it's important to provide them more opportunities to spawn to increase the numbers. They're a very long-lived species as well. So their reproduction doesn't occur as quickly and rapidly as other species. I think the females mature at 20 years of age. So they're not spawning till they're 20. And the males are 5 or 6 years when they spawn.
And I'm guessing that if you can manage the waters to make them hospitable for sturgeon, then in turn they'll be good for the walleye and the whitefish.
That's kind of the way we do it. We try and target our projects to the what we consider the most sensitive species, but obviously other species benefit. And, you know, we talk about walleye because they're such an exciting sport fish. And we talk about lake whitefish because they're important commercial species. But there's a whole host of other species, maybe 14 or 15 other species, that can make use of these habitats as well.
When you think of the sturgeon and you realize that this fish basically hasn't changed since the era of the dinosaurs, and you realize what a precarious position they're in, that they're threatened or endangered in 7 of the 8 Great Lakes states, it seems like a lousy way to treat a very ancient species. Do you have that sense that you're really fighting to maintain that link with history?
Yes. Yeah, so this is an important species for a number of reasons. I mean, they're culturally important, obviously, to the First Nations and tribal communities in the region. We think of them as a heritage species when we sort of write about them and communicate about them. And then they're also really exciting. Kids really get into the fact that they've been around since the dinosaur, and they're very attractive to kids. They're huge, for one thing, when they're mature. They can be up to 6 feet long. And so they are kind of the poster child for, you know, this restoration work and what it really means to not just the environment to restore it, but really our economy and our society.
So it's pretty exciting, I'm sure, to think that those pieces of limestone that you're carefully assembling right now are going to be paying off for who knows how long in the future.
Well, we hope that forever.
Jennifer Reed is the Deputy Director of the University of Michigan Water Center as we look at the underwater construction building 2 new spawning reefs on the St. Clair River. Thanks for coming in and talking with us, Jennifer.
Well, thank you for the opportunity.
Today's show was directed by Allie Billings. Our executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer today was Bob Scon. Contributors are Mercedes Mejia, Emily Fox, Chris Hattelsey, Taylor Mattia, Omar Saade, Kayla Steinberg, Katie Suha, and Brianna Tinsley. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.